You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So we titled this evening A Seismographic Attention, and a seismograph, thinking about that, which is a tool for measuring vibrations, is also thinking about it the way that a poet measures the minute shifts of perception in daily life, perhaps measures the very question, takes measure of the very question of what it means to be human, to be alive. Poetry for Jane Hirschfield really is an instrument of investigation. Maybe we talk about investigative journalists, maybe all poets are investigative, but this one certainly is. And think about where the revelation is and the mundane things that surround us at this minute is another question that Jane Hirschfield's poetry investigates. This podium, this piece of paper I'm reading from, and our collective presence in this auditorium, perhaps they all have a life of their own. The poet can bring us into conversation with and consciousness of the inanimate as well as the animate world, as Jane Hirschfield does in so many of her poems in the new poetry collection, The Beauty, which has a really beautiful cover. It's quite beautiful. For the past few months, as I've traveled, I've been carrying around this book, which is published simultaneously with Jane's new essay collection, 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. And in those essays, she brings what she calls in others, quote, the hawk's swoop voracity of mind when it is both precise and free. In these new essays, she offers a poet's extended meditation and investigation of the question, how do poems work? How do we work with the poem? How do we receive the poem? How does the poem work on us? How do we live? Jane Hirschfield's other major collection of essays is Nine Gates, Entering the Mind of Poetry. She's the author of 8 books of poetry and has edited and co-translated 4 books presenting work of poets from the past. She published her first poem in 1973, shortly after she graduated from Princeton as a member of the university's first graduating class to include women. She put aside her writing for nearly 8 years to study at the San Francisco Zen Center, some of that time at a remote location in the Coast Range. She's a recipient of numerous honors and awards and is currently a chancellor of the American Academy of Poets. It gives me a great pleasure. It's a great honor. Please join me in welcoming Jane Hirschfield. Thank you. To you.
Well, I am extraordinarily happy to be back in this amazing program. Thank you, Louise, for that. There couldn't be a better introduction. And thank you all for coming for the conversation tonight. I'm going to begin with just a little bit from the book of essays, just to give you a small sense of it, and then mostly be reading you poems and starting with the first paragraph of the preface seemed like a good place to start. Good art is a truing of vision, in the way a saw is trued in the saw shop to cut more cleanly. It is also a changing of vision. Entering a good poem, a person feels, tastes, hears, thinks, and sees in altered ways. Why ask art into a life at all, if not to be transformed and enlarged by its presence and mysterious means? Some hunger for more is in us, more range, more depth, more feeling, more associative freedom, more beauty, more perplexity and more friction of interest, more prismatic grief and unstunted delight, more longing, more darkness, more saturation and permeability in knowing our existence as also the existence of others, more capacity to be astonished. Art adds to the sum of the lives we would have, were it possible to live without it. And by changing selves one by one, art changes also the outer world that selves create and share. So that's how it starts. There are chapters on a number of different things, hiddenness, uncertainty, surprise, paradox, the impossible. What would happen if language woke up in the morning and nothing were there? What do you have to invite into the room before you can eventually end up starting to write a poem? I'm going to read you only one other brief excerpt, a little less brief than that one, but not much longer. And this is from a chapter called Poetry, Transformation, and the Column of Tears. And the transformations that you have been going through in the book up until now are both personal and large social upheavals. So it might help to understand the tone here, to know that you have been through some fairly harrowing war poems not long before this section. The experience of art takes place within and under the skin. When we read the word orange, neuroscientists have found, our taste buds grow larger, more so if we are hungry. There is no way to know in the provinces of art except by an empathy so profound that the division between self and other dissolves. Inside art, we are subject, not object. Inside poetry, whether it's reading or writing, we are, as the Greek word poesis tells us, makers, not only of words, but also of our own lives. One of the roles of poetry in and after the dark times of crisis is to remind that a life can keep faith with full feeling, full knowledge, no matter what it has come to see and know. For this, we need to be lured into the condition of being undefended. Beauty unbuckles pain's armoring. Unexpected startlement unfastens the psyche's fortifications. When we set down the narrow personal story and enter the stories and images of others, the armatures of self-protection dissolve. In the held breath of page, theater, or concerto, we allow what will happen to happen, and this agreement itself is the altering heart of catharsis. To be moved by a work of art is to stand with the cellist of Sarajevo, who during the long siege of that city would bring each day instrument and chair to play in a place where snipers routinely killed, reminding himself and others that it was possible to be human, unarmed and vulnerable, permeable to beauty, even then, even there. At its best and strangest, it may be that art must live in an openness exposed in every direction. And after another paragraph, we get to a haiku by Issa, "We wander the roof of hell, choosing blossoms." And when I talk about that poem, I talk about it in terms of how Chaplin-esque it is, how it is both iron and strict, but also dear and touching and human as an image. And from there, we will wander on to a sonnet by Gwendolyn Brooks, but that's all you're going to hear for now from the essay book. Poems. So yes, the cover is very beautiful, but if you look carefully, you will see that the leaves of the peach stem are tattered and the peaches are marred. And that mattered a lot to me. Beauty is not some saccharine, simple thing. It is hard won, easily lost, and then our task is to refind it. So I'll start here also with the opening poem in the book. It is called Fado. Many of you probably know, but some of you might not, that a fado is a kind of Portuguese song. Born in the 19th century on the docks of Lisbon, the song of outcasts, sailors, women of the night, dock workers, a kind of song which is known for the longing at its heart, but they also track the tribulations of daily life, of our fate in all of its senses. And fado is actually the normal Portuguese word for fate, although if you say fado to a Portuguese person, apparently they think of the song first, the way if you say rock and roll to us, we don't think of rocks and rolling. So, fado. A man reaches close and lifts a quarter from inside a girl's ear. From her hands takes a dove she didn't know was there. Which amazes more, you may wonder, the quarter's serrated murmur against the thumb or the dove's knuckled silence? That he found them or that she never had? Or that in Portugal, this same half-stopped moment, it's almost dawn, and a woman in a wheelchair is singing a fado that puts every life in the room on one pan of a scale, itself on the other, and the copper bowl's balance. That's a kind of... it's set before the first section in the book. It's a frontispiece poem. And then the first section has a large number of poems, almost all of whose titles begin with the word my. And this is a kind of, each of them as an individual poem is doing its own work. But set next to each other, I hope they begin to be recognized as a kind of exploration, not simply of my, but also of my-ness, the wonderful poem by Czesław Miłosz. My-ness has women sitting in a cafeteria talking about my family, my dog, my shopping, my shirts, my dinner. Very, very sweet little poem. But also a homonym in English, not what Czesław Miłosz would have had in mind, but for me, minus, M-I-N-U-S. There's actually a fair bit of elementary and weird math in this book. Don't be frightened. 2 + 3 = 5 is about the level of it. But this oscillation between self and non-self, the permeability of the boundaries between self and other, is something I've been pondering for a long time. And so these are poems of interconnection, provisionality, inseparability, and also whatever they happen to be about. So first, my skeleton. My skeleton, who once ached with your own growing larger, are now each year imperceptibly smaller, lighter, absorbed by your own concentration. When I danced, you danced. When you broke, I. And so it was lying down, walking, climbing the tiring stairs. Your jaws, my bread. Someday you, what is left of you, will be flensed of this marriage. Angular wrist bones arthritis, cracked harp of rib cage, blunt of heel, opened bowl of the skull, twin platters of pelvis. Each of you will leave me behind, at last serene. What did I know of your days, your nights? I who held you all my life inside my hands and thought they were empty. You who held me all your life in your hands, as a new mother holds her own unblanketed child, not thinking at all. So this next one began as some small percentage of poems do, with the New York Times Tuesday science section. I was working away, and I came across this article about how the scientists had figured out, finally, one of the great mysteries of life, how itch works. They hadn't known until 2013. And that got me thinking, and that got me writing. The things you might want to know for this poem to make a little better sense are the word protein, which is how itch works as a particular protein, comes from the Greek god Proteus, who changes shapes.
So proteins work by folding and unfolding, and that's how they communicate instructions from the DNA and RNA into action. And also the poem takes a bit of a detour into the marvelous, also fairly recent discovery, the microbiome, which is all of the many semi-independent lives that hang out within us and are in fact responsible for our moods, our ability to think, our health, our well-being. After I'd given an earlier reading from this book, it only came out in March, somebody sent me a marvelous note saying that there was a 1,000-year-old Tibetan medical text about the 84,000 beings inside us. So true. My proteins. They have discovered, they say, the protein of itch, naturetic polypeptide B, and that it travels its own distinct pathway inside my spine, as do pain, pleasure, and heat. A body, it seems, is a highway, a cloverleaf crossing, well-built, well-traversed. Some of me going north, some going south. 90% of my cells, they have discovered, are not my own person. They are other beings inside me, as 96% of my life is not my life. Yet I, they say, am they, my bacteria and yeasts, my father and mother, grandparents, lovers, my drivers talking on cell phones, my subways and bridges, my thieves, my police who chase myself night and day. My proteins, apparently also me, fold the shirts. I find in this crowded metropolis a quiet corner where I build of not-me Lego blocks a bench, pigeons, a sandwich of rye bread, mustard, and cheese. It is me and is not the hunger that makes the sandwich good. It is not me, then is the sandwich, a mystery neither of us can fold, unfold, or consume. You know, this is something I thought about a lot when I was 7 years old. You know, here's the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I take a bite, I swallow it. When does it stop being peanut butter and jelly and bread and start being me? I don't know. So this book is the third of my books, which is pretty amazing because I'm not actually that quick or prolific a writer, which is haunted by war grief in a quiet, under-the-surface way. Since you could see what was coming about 3 days after September 11th, 2001, and here we still are in what just seems endless, endless. So this is a poem of war grief which happens to be in the shape of an artichoke. My species. Even a small purple artichoke boiled in its own bittered and darkening waters, grows tender and sweet. Patience, I think, my species. Keep testing the spiny leaves, the spiny heart. I probably read this poem the last time I was here because I was in conversation with the marvelous Caltech astrophysicist, Sean Carroll. I like to apologize when I read it if there are any theoretical physicists in the room. I don't mean you. Quartz clock. The ideas of a physicist can be turned into useful objects. A rocket, a quartz clock, a microwave oven for cooking. The ideas of poets turn into only themselves, as the hands of the clock do, or the face of a person. It changes, but only more into the person. The start of this poem was a piece of writing advice I was given when I was 18, And it took a few decades for me to come to realize that it was also a pretty good piece of life advice. A cottony fate. Long ago, someone told me, avoid ore. It troubles the mind, as a held-out piece of meat disturbs a dog. Now I, too, am 60. There was no other life. In a kitchen where mushrooms were washed. In a kitchen where mushrooms were washed, the mushroom scent lingers, as the sea must keep for a long time the scent of the whale. As a person who's once loved completely, a country once conquered, does not release that stunned knowledge. They must want to be found, those strange-shaped rising morels, clownish puffballs. Lichens have served as a lampwick, clean-burning coconuts, olives, dried salmon, sheep fat, a carcass of petrol set blazing, light that is fume and abradement. Unburnable mushrooms are other. They darken the air they come into. There's the scent of having been traveled, been taken. It was after that experience that I understood that I, too, had the powers of a truffle pig. You know, I didn't know you could smell mushrooms. And then the next night when I was walking around, I could tell I was by a mushroom patch. And I went back the next day, and so I was. This book, like my previous few, has a series of very, very short poems. I run them as a series, but each one is independent. I just don't want to use up that many trees for poems that only last two or three lines. So I'll read you three of them. I know you think I've forgotten, but today in rain, without coat, without hat, immigration and hunger. I misread the journalist's sentence. In this human drama, the police ate the supporting actors. Now, I really looked at it a long time before I saw that what it said on the page was R, not ate. And this is next one is the shortest poem in the book. It's only two words long plus a title. And just to help you prime you, as the scientists say, don't think of sharks, don't think of tigers, think of the dentist's chair. Humbling an assay. Have teeth. Okay, I think I only have time for, I don't know, two or three more. Pause. Using up the time. This is so there'll be time for you to ask questions later on. My life was the size of my life. My life was the size of my life. Its rooms were room-sized. Its soul was the size of a soul. In its background, mitochondria hummed. Above it, sun, clouds, snow, the transit of stars and planets. It rode elevators, bullet trains, various airplanes, a donkey. It wore socks, shirts, its own ears and nose. It ate, it slept, it opened and closed its hands, its windows. Others I know had lives larger. Others I know had lives shorter. The depth of lives, too, is different. There were times my life and I made jokes together. There were times we made bread. Once I grew moody and distant. I told my life I would like some time. I would like to try seeing others. In a week, my empty suitcase and I returned. I was hungry then, and my life too was hungry. We could not keep our hands off, our clothes on, our tongues from. Two linen handkerchiefs. How can you have been dead 12 years and these still? And I will finish again in honor of Sean Carroll. And this poem I couldn't have read because it wasn't written yet when I was last here. A poem with another physics reference. It's called Entanglement, which refers to what's also known as strange charm, the experiments where, as is actually described in the poem, but they isolate an atom, you know, in Indiana, and they isolate one in Munich, and they change the spin of one, and the other one changes. Very interesting. The third line is French, ton en anglais. That just means you're entangled one. And that's all I'll say about it. Oh, I will say, this is going to be someday the first poem that Discover magazine, the science magazine, ever publishes. But they're holding it until they get an article about the phenomenon. And so I have no idea when it will ever come out. They said they don't care that the book is out. They want to wait for the article. Entanglement. A librarian in Calcutta and an entomologist in Prague signed their moon-faced illicit emails ton en anglais. No one can explain it. The strange charm between border collie and sheep, leaf and wind, the two distant electrons. There is, too, the matter of a horse race. Each person shouts for his own horse louder, confident in the rising din, past whip, past mud, the horse will hear his own name in his own quickened ear. Desire is different. Desire is the moment before the race is run. Has an electron never refused the invitation to change direction, sent in no knowable envelope with no knowable ring? A story told often. After the lecture, the widow insisting the universe rests on the back of a turtle. And what, the physicist asks, does the turtle rest on? Very clever, young man, she replies, very clever, but it's turtles all the way down. And so a woman in Beijing buys for her love, who practices turtle geometry in Boston, a metal trinket from a night market street stall. On the back of a turtle, at rest on its shell, a turtle. Inside that green-painted shell, another, still smaller. This continues for many turtles, until finally, too small to see or to lift up by its curious, preacherly head, a single, ungreen electron waits the width of a world for some weightless message sent into the din of existence for it alone. Murmur of all that is claspable, clabberable, clamberable, against all that is not. You are there. I am here. I remember. Thank you.
That was quite a journey with the turtles.
Yes.
Yeah. It's really beautiful, really beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm thinking of the things, the after images of some of these poems, I mean, the way we receive them and what lingers. And from the essays, I was reminded, I'm so glad it was there in what you read today, that the cellist of Sarajevo, What a great personage to evoke in these times, but also as a way of speaking about all that your book speaks about, what the poet does, that sense of being unprotected.
Right.
How did that come to you, that very image? Was that right there at the beginning of the book?
Oh, no, nothing is ever right there at the beginning. Everything for me emerges when it's needed. I never know when I'm writing either a poem or an essay what will come. And for the essays, for the poems, sometimes I know there's something that I need desperately to think and feel through in the way that only poems do for me. But often it's more I am listening inside of a kind of, I don't know what you would call the state of being pregnant before you're pregnant, but I feel something is there.
If anyone could come up with a word for it.
Right. I'm sure I believe could. Technically it's called ovulating, but never mind. And with a little help from the outside, which is exactly how poems work, you know, there's something inside that's ready, there's something outside that comes. But for the essays, I started all of them with a question.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's hard to find a good question, but I try to find a good question, and then you become a magnet, and things that either you have thought about in the past or that you encounter in the present moment. The Cellist of Sarajevo was such a startling occurrence that it's unforgettable even for someone like me with no memory. And so when I needed him, he was there.
It's almost like he comes up like we recall poems. It's like you say what was that wonderful phrase? The poems we carry forward as individuals and culture are those that strike us powerfully enough that they call up the need for their own recall, and maybe these times call up the need to think about the Cellist of Sarajevo.
Yes.
It's such a strong image. So we're going to move a little bit back and forth between the essays and the poems. I mean, it's really quite astonishing to have both of these emerge at the same time. But that also relates to the first question I was going to ask you, because about your own writing of poetry, because you write in the essay book. So you're writing as a poet in the book with poet's mind about the work mainly of other poets.
Entirely of other poets. I never use my own work.
You do not use your own work. So we'll maybe read some of yours here with the methodology that you suggest in the book. But you talk about, in the book, the irritant beginning as it differs from any poet's. It's a great phrase, like sort of like an oyster, you know, like starting around this little piece of sand. You say that for Rilke, it was the desire, quote, I love this, to plunder the honey of the visible in order to gather it into the great golden hive of the invisible. And you talk about the many reasons that poets write poems. It could be injustice, Akhmatova, rage at oppression, Whitman. So what would you say is your own goad into poetry? Is it a discomfort or is it a joy? Is it both?
I think it is probably universal that if you're in a state of complete joy with no disturbance, you don't need to do anything further about it. That there always has to be a little bit of fracture or imbalance. And of course, the wonderful thing about even joy, you know, maybe not in the absolute fullness of the moment, but joy ends. And so transience is the great goad for all of us. Mm. The fact that time will always bring us to lose whatever it is we think we have, we will lose. So that is always there. And for me, that's one of the abiding ones. But every poem was probably brought into being by a slightly different cause of grief or off-balanceness or question or sometimes simply the feeling that one does not want to lead a superficial life. Mm. I mean, many years ago, when the Velvet Revolutions were happening in Eastern Europe, I first read about them in the newspaper, and I was just really happy. It's like it never occurred to me that there could be such large political change without bloodshed.
Mm.
And then I fairly quickly began to think about that part of the world and its history in the 20th century. And of course, later on, there was Sarajevo. But in those first weeks and months, it seemed as if something amazing was going to happen. But I simply felt that just being happy was a really insufficient response. And I wanted to think about it more deeply. And I couldn't. Hmm. I could find no entrance gate to think more seriously about this. And then I finally had the bright idea that maybe I should try to write a poem. And then I found an idea, which was revision. Mm. When something is revised, what happens to what was there before? Mm. And then I began to find my way into the poem, which ended up being called History as the Painter Bonnard. For those of you who saw the movie Mr. Turner, his revising, Bonnard did that even more. You know, we are continually revising what was before, but that doesn't mean that what was before is completely vanished.
Absolutely.
And in oil paintings, it comes back. You know, after a few hundred years, the paint grows thin and the previous position of the leg becomes visible as a kind of ghost leg again.
And so you're kind of making that as a metaphor, like for that history is kind of leaking.
Yes,
leaking through.
Yes. And that for me, then I began to feel like I was starting to grapple with how I could feel about these changes. And as I said, you know, later there was so much bloodshed and turmoil that it was terrifying.
And you write with such affection in the book, in the essay book, and such deep understanding of so many poets, so many different kinds of poets, from Uwoj to Whitman, Dickinson, Koch. But I feel like you have a particular, you gave him a whole chapter, affection for Basho. Am I saying it right? You say Basho?
Yes, Basho.
Basho. So do you see yourself, the great Japanese poet, do you see yourself particularly in his lineage? I mean,
well, it's very interesting. I hadn't, because my earlier co-translation was of the two great women poets from Japan's classical age, long before Basho, and I had always felt my sympathy for Komachi and Shikibu. I wrote about Basho because I was asked to speak about him in public libraries around the country, so it was a kind of assigned task, something I can't do with poems but can sometimes do with prose. And it was only after I had investigated his life, thought about it, looked at his poems, looked at his story, that I began to see, in a way, how strangely parallel our lives are. Not to make any claim that I have made a discovery as great as he did in the realm of poems, but one thing which was really interesting to me was that he also was a serious student of Zen who decided not to become an ordained priest and made a real choice towards lay life and lay practice and poetry as a practice. He wandered around a lot more with greater difficulty. You know, he walked thousands of miles out in the weather with just his straw hat and his. He often wore priest robes, even though he wasn't ordained. I tend to travel by airplane, but you know, he was a traveling teacher.
Right.
And gosh.
You know, I was thinking about that. The you as the traveler, you know, moving through space, and also, which leads me into one of the poems of yours I wanted to talk about, when he writes, to learn about the pine tree, go to the pine tree, to learn from the bamboo, study bamboo. When I was in Japan, the swan uncle in this little town where there were swans, he said, if you want to learn to be about the swans, you must be a swan, you must go to the swan. But what about cork boards? Thus the time, Jane wrote a poem about her cork board, and I would like you to read it, because when you talk about Basho, you talk about wabi, which was a beautiful discussion, the beauty of ordinary circumstances and objects. So this is a pretty ordinary object, which after your poem, I will never be able to look at in the same way again. It's on page 14, if you
Thanks.
Want.
Thanks. I'll accept your book.
Okay.
I just want to say one more thing that I should have said before I read this, which is, you know, every American poet is actually in the lineage of Basho, because the early 20th century imagists, you know, Pound, William Carlos Williams, whom we are all the children of, no matter how our writing looks on the page, that movement came from the early translations of haiku, and haiku came from Basho. And so the debt is enormous, abiding, and ubiquitous. Anyhow, back to ordinary objects and becoming them. So this poem is actually talking to my corkboard. However many holes are in you, There's always room for another. However much you carry, you can hold more. Like a saint making a joke, imperfection of surface suits you. Your seams remind of quiet tectonic plates. Phthonic corkboard, always beneath, even when hung on your vertical side, your waiting thumbtacks seem to me a glittering affection, the mi casa, su casa, of a door standing open in every weather of invitation. I apologize to you, corkboard. I, who would like to be more like you in spirit, cover you over with maps, plans, bills. Even these words that praise you further disguise you. So, and the poem actually was tacked up on a big cork board covering it.
If that's not empathy with the inanimate, I don't know what is, but I really literally, you know, it's right there above my telephone in the kitchen. Still have a landline.
Me too.
And, I would never think, to choose to write a poem about it was just so marvelous.
Well, I never would have known I was going to until the moment I did. Mm. This is often the case for me that, things, if somebody said to me, write a poem about a corkboard or write a poem about the soaps in a hotel or write a poem about your heart being broken, I would go, I can't do that. And then some moment comes and it's the only thing you can do.
Mm.
Poems are written out of desperate invention. And when you need something, it will leap into your arms, you hope.
There's so much room in that poem, too. Because the corkboard, it does make space. I started really kind of thinking about it, because I always love, and things are always falling off the corkboard, too.
Mm.
So it's accommodating, and yet sometimes it spews them back out.
Mine doesn't. You must have an amazing
corkboard.
You're hanging very heavy things.
Yeah, very heavy things. I love when you talk about the poem, as you say, call it a playable organ of perception. Mm. And you talk about how the poem really is, you say it's not fruit plucked off the tree. We don't get to just do it by ourselves. You called it, this is such a beautiful phrase, a ripening collaboration of artist, receiver, and world. So I thought I would ask you to read a poem that I found kind of wonderfully perplexing, which was The One Not Chosen, and see what we can together make of this.
Okay. The One Not Chosen. Third sister, aunt one forgets to send a card to. Boy on a bench, second smallest, not quick, not precise, not cunning. Cold chick, branch bruised peach, chair wobbly, unused, set in a corner. For some, almost good, almost lucky not to be chosen, though equally accidental. The 30-year buried landmine chooses the leg of another. How the mouth struggles to say it. Lucky. Good. Most are not chosen. Most mostly watch. So it must be. The watched, not escaping pride, not truly minding, bemoan their responsibilities. So many anxieties, demands, complications. And still, any rabbit the center of its own rabbit world, its universe axis, a nest of tamped-down grasses. It looks out its ground-level eyes, is warm, is curious, hungry. Its heart beats faster or slower with its own rabbit fate. A rabbit's soul cannot help but choose its own ears, its own paws, its own startlement, sleepiness, longings. It has a rabbit allegiance. And the pink nose, which could have been drawn in charcoal by Dürer's sister, but wasn't, takes in its own warmth and fur scent, glints pinkly, pinkly alters the distant star's light in its own caniculan corner among vast and unanswerable worlds, without even knowing it does so. So what would you like to know?
And I promise,
actually, there was one reviewer who loved this book and did her absolute best to wrap her mind around why there was a science fiction space rabbit in the book, which seemed so out of keeping with it. And it really worried me. You all didn't hear a space rabbit, did you? It's a very earthly little rabbit,
very earthly
right,
rabbit.
Right here.
And I promise the next time we do this kind of looking at poems, I will make copies for the audience.
Oh, that would be
poems.
Nice.
That would have been a good idea. So it starts, may I refer to the poem?
Yes.
You know it probably better than I do.
Well, what page is it? I'll open my
book. It's on
my
page 74.
Thank you.
So I guess I was immediately hooked into this poem because I'm the aunt one forgets to send a card to. Why did that jump out at me? The boy on the bench, I was seeing the boy on the bench. I was seeing like my one niece that, you know, gets compared to her sister, you know, who's the athletic one, never chosen. The culled chick, all those things. And then we're in the landmine. That was such a remarkable leap. And I'm wondering, as we, and you, and the poet pausing, it hurts you to even say that.
Well, it just felt ethically wrong, in fact, to even say good or lucky.
And yet you, I like.
And so I had to put it in the poem.
I liked that you put it in the poem. And then is this, so when we veer off into the rabbit, is that a window? Jane talks about the windows. I mean, have you opened a window into a completely, because the poem veers off. I mean, suddenly I'm chasing this, I'm off with the rabbit. And but then I'm worried, then I'm thinking about the rabbits. Can the rabbit choose its own ears? I mean, it does.
Well, it can't not.
It can't not.
And that's a bit of my point, is that for all of us, you know, no matter how much, first of all, we all have occasions when we feel like the one not chosen. I can't imagine anybody who never feels like they're the rejected, overlooked one.
And yet what a category to call attention to. It's like, which I think you do so beautifully. There's the things, these universal experiences that you're able to name. You're able to summon out of the quotidian experience that we're all, I would never think to find a category for it.
Well, I think one of the jobs of poetry, and it has many, many possible jobs, but one of them is to notice what isn't noticed and to bring that into awareness, investigation, the word you used in your introduction.
I had to look up caniculum.
Yes, well, so did I. I actually
that makes me feel better.
But it's a cognate of the old English word coney. It just means rabbity. It's just a fancy Latin word for rabbity. So, but it sounds so nice with the alliteration caniculum corner. But you know, the point here is that even if you're the one who feels rejected or ignored, or you know, the rabbit hiding and not noticed, and Durer Durer did the hare, not the rabbit. That's why I had to put his sister in. Yes, big difference. Bad mistake to refer to Durer's rabbit. I wrote a poem that I had to throw away because of that. But you know, in fact, each of these things—that branch bruised peach, that chair, that boy. They are the center of their own world. And in a way, you know, if you can simply find the recognition that no crumb of this universe is not its center, then perhaps our feelings would not be quite so badly hurt by the fact that we are equally validly and truly not the center of any universe.
That's beautiful.
That's
great. That's really great. I want to save time for you to ask questions, so be thinking of your questions. I picked several of the poems, but I perhaps will. Do we have time for one more poem to do?
Sure.
You did a wonderful talking about how poets make statements and how a statement is really, how voice comes from this making a statement. You said in your inimitable way, it's how a poem reaches for its hat. Isn't that a great phrase? I love that. So even the act of voicing has a way, you have a way of seeing it in an unusual way. So One of your most, I think, assertive poems is Hammer and Nails.
Oh, yes.
And I thought that would be fun to hear. And what? That is, I didn't write down the page on that. So
we'll find it.
We will find it.
One of us will find it. One of us will tell the other.
Between the two of us. It's on page 71.
Thank you. Okay, yes. As a hammer speaks to a nail. When all else fails, fail boldly, fail with conviction. As a hammer speaks to a nail, or a lamp left on in daylight. Say one. If two does not follow, say three. If that fails, say life. Say future. Lacking future, try bucket. Lacking iron, try shadow. If shadow too fails, if your voice falls and falls and keeps falling, meets only air and silence, say one again, but say it with greater conviction, as a nail speaks to a picture, as a hammer left on in daylight.
So, and I think that's one of those poems where that phrase is going to like come up upon me when I'm least expecting it. When all else fails, fail boldly, I will tell myself over and over, over and over again. Can you tell us anything about the moment of the inception of this poem?
Yeah, I had nothing to say. I wanted to, I had the chance to write. I was in circumstances where I very rarely do this. I'm not one of the dutiful daily good writers who writes a poem a day no matter what.
So that answers that question.
Yeah. I am, Louise Glick and I, the great models of silence in American poetry. But when I am in a place where I am being given every chance to write, i.e. what's called an artist colony, that is the one time when I do write every day. And I had to write something because I'm not allowed, I don't let myself go to dinner if I haven't written something. And so I wrote this. Well, if all else fails, fail boldly, fail with conviction. And so the poem came to be.
That's wonderful. I love
it. There was also in that place, there was a lamp which was left on in daylight 24 hours a day. And I had been looking at it for a long time. I mean, this is that collaboration of inner dialogue, outer world, and reader. I found it very moving, this light on in full daylight. Mm. And so that image had been sort of waiting for something to
come meet
it. And then
it found its way.
Yeah.
It found the perfect place.
Yeah.
One last question, and then we'll turn it over to you for questions, and then we're going to save a little time for Jane to read one piece at the end. One interesting assertion that you made in the book that really made me think, in the essay book, you say, American poets speak from the edge, not the center of culture, tradition, power. And I was wondering, at a time, perhaps thinking about Claudia Rankine's Citizen, but also what could be the advantages of not speaking from the center, of being those who don't speak from the center?
Well, I think there's a huge advantage, which is you can see the rest.
Mm.
I mean, just visually, physically, if you are at the edge, you can see everything. If you're in the center, you're always facing some particular direction.
And those in the center would be those from which traditions would you say are speaking from the center, perhaps?
Well, I was thinking of our current celebrity culture. Mm. I was thinking of, who do you see in the newspaper? The powerful, and they're so busy being powerful, they can't step back and notice the unnoticed.
Yeah, that I'm so glad I asked, because I wasn't even thinking of it within our own culture. I was thinking American poets as opposed to French poets or Icelandic poets. Mm. Or
no, I actually think all poets now are peripheral. The comparison that was probably in the back of my mind, and this is a quote from a long essay saying many things. I had been asked to talk in China about what's American about modern American poetry. So that whole essay came from that question. And it's partly written And the Chinese, of course, themselves have a great tradition of poets who began as government officials, leave the capital, go move into either the wilderness or some little village, and then become the great poets whose words we know today. So there's a great tradition of having been in the center, but then leaving the center. But you know, poetry, when there was, I'm going to get a little scholarly here, when there was no writing, poetry's job was to preserve knowledge in a way that it would stay in place. So rhyme and meter are memorable. They are tools of memorability. And so, you know, it's now understood that marvelous as the Homeric epics are on many, many levels, one thing they were doing was sort of, you know, it's the mismanners of, you know, when a stranger comes to your house, how do you treat them? When you're launching a warship, how do you do that? It's the Wikipedia of its day, these long, epic, memorized poems. They are holding information in place. They're holding lineage in place. They're holding history in place. Once writing came and things could be remembered stably without being recited in rhyme and meter with vivid narrative and memorable image and vivacious metaphor, then poetry began to do this work of looking at what wasn't noticed. And I think in our culture, sometimes we hold the work of feeling in a culture where so much practicality is put forward. Simply, you know, again, China's on my mind for a reason Louise knows. You know, the Chinese poets who went into exile after Tiananmen Square, what made them dissidents, what made them jailable, was that they were writing love poems, and you weren't supposed to. So when we think about what is activist poetry in America, I want a very, very wide, big terrine of a soup bowl, because, you know, simply to keep the life of the emotions awake is already a countercultural desire. In a culture where the main force of it is this fire hose of practical and economic thinking. Now, economic justice is really important, but the only way we will ever come to realize that it's important is this fundamental act of empathy.
Right.
Of knowing that no one's life is separate from my life, and that the slightest, you know, twinge of itchiness in the hands of fate, and I could be that person pushing a shopping cart down the street.
I'm glad I asked.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Jane. We have microphones. Do we have questioners? Okay.
Thank you. Hello. One hello. Thank you for transporting us, Lady Jane. My curiosity realizes that the celloist from Sarajevo still survives here and now, but has she survived there and then?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Probably still alive. Imagine being that person, going to the supermarket, picking up your groceries.
Good evening. Thank you very much. Obviously, your poems have a really kind of elegant, spare quality to them. And I'm wondering, how would you, do you think that's partially an influence of your Zen studies on your poetry?
You know, there is no way of my being able to know who I would be or what my writing would be like if I had not spent those 8 years as I did. But I don't want to make any special claim for Zen practice or Buddhist practice, because you can find these qualities in poets throughout time in every part of the world. And in fact, my feeling is that, you know, if Zen were not recreatable by any person sitting down and paying attention, how could it be a fully human truth? So a vocabulary will maybe help you. A set of instructions about this is what meditation looks like. And I'm sure it trained me to a certain kind of ability to pay attention and certainly to the intention of permeability. But I think you can find those in poets everywhere.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how in drafting a poem you move it from being something that you're very conscious of to something that everyone in the room can be conscious of.
So I sometimes when I teach and I talk about revision, I do it in terms of what I think of as revising from the inside and revising from the outside. And I oscillate between those two ways of reading my own poems. So when I'm revising from the inside, I'm still trying to find out, have I felt through this question? Have I allowed myself enough freedom? Have I taken risks? Have I found the music for it? Have I found, you know, is there too much? Should I pare it down? All those things have to do with my own happiness and my own sense of having found something. Because one needn't be this way, but I write, if I was left on a desert island with, you know, my publication was wet sand and the ocean came and erased it every night, I would still do it. But once you seem to be publishing a fair bit, it sort of sinks in that, oh, other people are going to start reading these things. Then you realize it's a great courtesy to people to try to imagine, if I weren't me and I didn't know my own circumstances, I didn't know why I was writing this poem, I didn't know what I was thinking about when I was writing this poem, is it comprehensible? You know, and if it's not comprehensible, is there a way to help that reader without, you know, bludgeoning them with a 2x4? So sometimes a fact is needed. Sometimes you'll put it in the title. Sometimes you just realize, oh, that's a little ambiguous. And sometimes you just simply want to be more surprised. You know, there's a cliche in one of the poems I read tonight, a great big cliche, which is that thing of, you know, I leave my life and then in a week my empty suitcase and I return. That's right out of a sitcom. And I had to make my best guess whether this was going to offend people or please them, because we all know you're not supposed to put cliches in your poem. And I just sort of hoped I'd gotten away with it. But I did think about you, the reader, when I made the decision to publish that poem. And I guess it was all right because The New Yorker took it. But I didn't know when I sent it to The New Yorker whether it was all right or not. I just said, well, let somebody else figure that out. I think there's also, and I say this with some reluctance because I don't like to admit it to myself, but when you have published several books and you understand that, you know, however small the poetry reading public in America is, there are some people out there, I think it's possible that you begin to feel a sense of responsibility a little bit to take on certain things, to be aware of certain things. And I think that's a very dangerous position. But I have to say, I've noticed it has come into my life because I do have readers and they do talk to me. I wrote a poem after September 11th that got fairly circulated. After the Christmas tsunami in 2004, I got an email from somebody saying, oh, I loved your September 11th poem. Thank you so much for that. I can't wait to see what you do about this. I was flabbergasted. And I thought, you know, just as we were talking about with the corkboard poem, I thought, I couldn't possibly write a poem about the tsunami. And then, as is so often what happens with me, a couple of days later, I thought, well, why can't I? Why do I feel like the tsunami is not something you can write a poem about? And then I got to thinking about the difference between violence that human beings do to one another and an act of nature. Mm. And that contrast was actually what brought me to the poem that I ended up writing, which was a bit, it's a much shorter poem, but it's a bit like the one not chosen, in that what I'm thinking about is the people who are swept up in tragedies they had no part in making. Mm-hmm. So its title is Those Who Cannot Act. You know, the Greek chorus, not the protagonist. I hope I've answered your question enough.
Maybe two more questions?
Thank you so much. It's been such a gift. Your poems have been a source of spiritual nourishment for me for many years. And as well as your TED Talk, The Art of Metaphor.
Ah.
Lovely. And my question is, I love metaphors as well, but I have a desire to cleanse perception and not to add more filters to my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that metaphors can help me enter into a new world, but they can also obscure because the metaphors are not the things themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious how you relate to metaphors and where you see their limitations, how you transcend them.
Yeah, so this might be a little baffling for those of you who either aren't, you know, real up to date on even the word metaphor or the idea of it, let alone not having seen it. It's just a little 6-minute TED Ed piece. It's animated. You don't see me at all, which is kind of great. I could never give a real TED Talk. They have to stand up there without notes and stride around.
I can see a poem about a TED Talk, though, coming on.
let somebody else write that. Thank you. Good point. I guess I have a very, very, very broad conception of metaphor and how it works in our lives. So there's, you know, there's similes, which are comparisons when you say this is like that. And there's metaphors where you just say, you know, the moon is a milk jug. And then there's, in some ways, I feel like even the most direct statement, there is an apple tree outside my window. Once that's put into a poem, it's actually functioning in the way of metaphor, because the very nature of poetic mind, of poetic reading, you've changed your frame of being when you call something poetry. And you feel the tree differently. You feel the window differently. So I know there are people I respect who would disagree with this statement, but I really think every description, every landscape in a painting or in a poem or in art of any kind is a description of a state of soul and is understood that way, because that's what we turn to art to do. And I love the premise of your question. It's a very precise thought to have in mind, and I admire that you have come up with enough sort of skepticism of what it is to make art to understand that you don't want to make curtains, you want to make clarities. And sometimes the best way to clarity is metaphor, because metaphors will, I mean, in the narrower sense, because they are multi-legible. Mm. I mean, in this book, I talk about, there's a beautiful little haiku by Issa, on a branch floating down river, a cricket singing. On a branch floating down river, a cricket singing. And depending on my own mood and my own state of life, I can read that poem and find it gallant, or I can read that poem and find it bitter. Mm. So it's an image, read metaphorically, but opening in about 10 different directions of how that image might resonate for you, depending on the day, depending on who you are. And I think that's, in fact, the gift of poetry, that it doesn't narrow the world. So bad poems obfuscate. Good poems allow us to comprehend mystery.
And a last question.
My friend and I were reading your poem, Each Moment a White Bull.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you choose a white bull as the gift, as the beginning and ending?
Right. So I can't even read you that poem because it's from an earlier book that I don't have with me. The title is Each Moment a White Bull Steps Shining into the World. And it actually comes from the realm of Greek mythology. So a white bull is a very special bull. But it's good. I didn't want people to figure out what myth it was referring to because the poem isn't very closely knitted to the actual myth that I was thinking about. But, you know, a bull has certain resonances, power, terrifying. In Greek mythology, Zeus sometimes becomes a bull. Europa is carried off by a bull. You know, it's a rather terrifying beast. A white bull is an even more mythical, terrifying beast. And the gist of the poem, for those of you who've never read it, is basically saying, take care of it. If you are given the difficult task of something absolutely terrifying and demanding coming into your life, tend it. You know, give it a jeweled halter, feed it, learn to love it, and then when you have to slaughter it, give it back to the gods as an act of sacrifice, plunge in the knife, that isn't the point. The point is that you came to love it. So it's a poem about how to deal with the unbearable difficulties that your lives, each of them, has had. There's none of us who escapes it. And it's a poem I've heard a lot of stories about. For a long time, I didn't give it at readings. And then people started coming to me and saying, you know, such and so happened to me. And I read that poem. Mm-hmm. And I started reading it again when I give readings from all the books. I hope that helped. We have one more desperate question.
Mm.
Do you sometimes not let people know? Right. How does that work? Could you all hear that question? Okay, what she asked was basically, you know, what do I think about the fact that sometimes people are going to read the poem cold and they're not going to hear all of this background talk and no explanation, and is that all right, and how do I deal with that? I sometimes say you come to poetry readings to get the gossip about the poems, because people will tell you these background things. But I expect my poems to be read without explanation. I'm a little bit of an old New Critic poet that way. I do not want you sort of, you know, rummaging through the drawers of my life and saying, oh, well, she wrote that because such and so happened. I'm not a very factually revealing poet. Very few of my poems give you any sense of, you know, the actual personal history that caused them. And I think it's fine for you to have your own associations and feeling and conclusions. That's the compact writers make with readers, because after all, we're not going to meet all of you and take you out to a cup of coffee and shake you until you tell us what you thought the things meant and then tell you whether you're right or wrong. We have to trust you and trust you that you will, if you care to turn the page and keep reading at all, that you are finding something of your own to bring to the poem, and that in fact is, how did I learn poetry? Reading the poems of others. Without them there, you know, Horace couldn't tell me what he was thinking about when he wrote his long letters from Roman exile. Basho couldn't tell me. I don't know what Basho would think about what I have said about his poems. Fortunately, he's dead. He won't ever know. But poems are meant to be freestanding buildings, not held up by their writers. So you have my permission to make whatever you wish of my work.
That's the collaboration.
That's
the collaboration. I would also like to say for the record, before we conclude this with the final reading, that all the clocks in the library have stopped. It didn't stop during this reading, but I think it should go on the record that we were here while all the clocks were stopped. So we were in free time with Jane Hirschfield. Thank you so much, Jane. I wonder if you would conclude by reading the last part from the Ten Windows.
I will. I'm going to stand up.
Okay.
You have more breath when you stand up.
Then I will move over here so I can see.
Okay, so the very end of the very last chapter. And this is the chapter on paradox. To finish this tour of paradox and expansion, let us look at two poets in a relatively unusual condition for poets, at least in their poems. They are happy. Few good poems are capable of shepherding happiness onto the page, just as relatively few, are there any, are capable of holding entirely untroubled love. Grief is simpler. There, word beauty and world lore provide the counterweight ballast. If we're still breathing and speaking, that is evidence of wanting to live. The writing of happiness requires its own counterpull gesture. Some part of the poem must doubt its own sayings lasting. Here first, then, is an early poem by Frank O'Hara, Today. Oh, kangaroos, sequins, chocolate sodas, you really are beautiful. Pearls, harmonicas, jujubes, aspirins, all the stuff they've always talked about still makes a poem a surprise. These things are with us every day, even on beachheads and beers. They do have meaning. They're strong as rocks. And here is a late poem, unpublished during his life, by Raymond Carver. Soda crackers. You, soda crackers. I remember when I arrived here in the rain, whipped out and alone, how we shared the aloneness and quiet of this house, and the doubt that held me from fingers to toes as I took you out of your cellophane wrapping and ate you meditatively at the kitchen table that first night with cheese and mushroom soup. Now, a month later to the day, an important part of us is still here. I'm fine. And you, I'm proud of you too. You're even getting remarked on in print. Every soda cracker should be so lucky. We've done all right for ourselves. Listen to me. I never thought I could go on like this about soda crackers, but I tell you, the clear, sunshiny days are here at last. Each of these poems, in quite different ways, holds some undertow shiver and backward lean. In each, happiness looks back a little over its shoulder. In Frank O'Hara's poem, the first hint appears in the title. If this is today, what of the other days? What of tomorrow, once today passes? The more defined a period of time, the more we feel it is vulnerable, subject to transience. The larger evidence of undertow, though, and what erases any doubt that undertow is present, is the poem's reference to beers and beachheads. O'Hara served in the Second World War, whose graves and sites of carnage those words remember. The experience comes back again more subtly in the poem's last line. What can it mean to say so improbably of kangaroos, jujubes, aspirins, and sequins, they are strong as rocks? Rocks are, for the sonar operator of a destroyer, as O'Hara was, an unforgiving danger. For anyone, they are cold, immobile, inanimate, and the obdurate opposite of sequins and aspirin. The statement places the trinkets and the miner next to death, measures both, praises both, and calls them equal, which is indeed the most generous possible grant of any day's meaning. Raymond Carver's celebration of soda crackers also holds implausibility out in the open. Soda crackers are plain. the offering of a minimal cupboard, and odd to find celebrated in an ode. However much we've grown used to unexpected praisings after Neruda's outpouring of odes to socks, ticking watches, and dead fish in the market, familiarity can't block the initial surprise. The coupling of extraordinary and meager will always be found peculiar. A soda cracker is even stranger when chosen as something to speak to directly. I asked Tess Gallagher, Raymond Carver's widow, about this poem, wondering if the crackers might have had some special meaning at the end of his life. She answered no, then added, "I think soda crackers are just a staple in working-class houses, so you're likely to find them in scantily supplied place and be assured you won't go hungry. They are saving food. My generation grew up with them in our chili and soup." By the time I'd received Gallagher's answer, I'd already realized the poem's meaning would be unchanged, whatever she said. "An important part of us is still here. I'm fine." Abyss lies under that statement either way. The announcement, "I'm fine," when made in a poem, declares, "I might not be." Just as the declaration, "I tell you the clear sunshiny days are here at last," informs us that Carver knows well that lasting is not the way of days. Sunshiny. What a sublimely self-skeptical adjective made simply by adding a Y. Lies need assertion. Truths take care of themselves. Each of these poems gives full space to both sides of amplitude's making. Both hold immunization against self-deception. Raymond Carver really is happy, even knowing full well it won't last. Frank O'Hara's allegiance is to both rock and joy. A person able to put two knowledges into one funny, handmade, awkward word is a person who might take on, vulnerably, expansively, happily, that most impossible of human questions, how we go on at all, knowing each beloved unfinishedness will finish without us. Impossible to ponder, done every day, sometimes with crackers. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.